You are listening to Eon. AEON.net.au.
You are listening to the TER podcast, the Teachers Education Review.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Teachers Education Review, the Australian podcast for teachers that bridges the gap between research, policy and practice. This is episode number 116, released on Wednesday the 15th of March, 2023. I'm Cameron Malcher. In this episode, Stephen Kolber looks at ways to mix up giving feedback to students in Kolber's Corner. Tom Marnie looks at a certain absence of a key foundational document in educational discourse in ideology and education. I look at the role that education is playing in the upcoming New South Wales state election. And for our main feature, I speak with Victorian languages teacher Olivia Elzingray about his recently completed PhD thesis on motivation and students' learning of language. This podcast is produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and extend those respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening to this podcast. This episode is going online on the first day of the 2023 NAPLAN exams, and it is the first time they have been brought forward to be conducted in Term 1, the rationale being that teachers and schools will hopefully get the results at some point during the year that makes them still able to be used in a meaningful way to inform future teaching and learning. It's also the first year that the exams have gone completely online. And so the question of how much is this a test of students' literacy abilities versus how much has this become a test of their keyboard skills and their ability to comfortably and confidently navigate a computer is something that has been a common trend in a discussion about this year's NAPLAN exams. Of course, the ongoing dispute around NAPLAN Online remains. The first time that NAPLAN Online was trialled, there were issues with devices using particular operating systems, particularly the Apple operating system, still allowing students to access spelling correction and certain tools that basically negated the very elements that NAPLAN was meant to assess and the degree to which those have been universally stamped out and that those issues have been addressed in this nationwide computer-based test rollout. Well, I suppose we'll see those reports coming through over the next few days. Anyway, wherever you are to those teachers who have had the job of administering NAPLAN in their schools and coordinating the many computers needed to let students sit this test in an effective way, well done on what I'm sure has been a very stressful period, and I do hope that the work is appreciated in your school and that perhaps this national policy agenda, depending on technology in schools, might also bring a bit more attention to the state of technology rollout in schools and the needs of some schools to be able to achieve such a nationwide goal. Of course, the other thing about NAPLAN this year that's changing is the way it's going to be marked and reported. While the marking, as I understand it, remains largely the same, it's going to be reported this year not on the full range of bands, of achievement bands that it's marked against, but it will be reported against only four bands, which will represent four levels of achievement, being exceeding at the very top, so students who are well ahead of expectations for the particular year group they're in. Then there will be strong, so the students who are basically meeting, you know, confidently meeting all requirements of, or not requirements, sorry, but all expectations of their year group. Then there will be developing, those students who are either just meeting some or have some work needing to be done on other areas of assessment. And then at the bottom will be needs additional support, those students whose capacity to complete the test indicates that they might need targeted learning, either in numeracy or some aspects of literacy. And again, this has been criticised, particularly from one side of politics and the media, because this year's NAPLAN will no longer be directly comparable to previous years. The public data reporting that's available through MySchool will no longer allow it won't feed into the historical trend data in the way that it has in the past. So there's been a bit of a grievance around that because, well, there are some people who want that data for various reasons. We know that some aspects of the media, one of their biggest money-making publications during the year are the newspapers that have NAPLAN league tables attached to them. And with the results reported and compressed down into only four bands, it'll be a little bit harder to differentiate schools as much as has been done in the past. So things like those league tables will not necessarily have the granular kind of data that allows them to rank, say, all nearly 2,500 public schools in New South Wales, for example. Anyway, with the tests only just being sat today, I'm sure there is much more to hit the news and the public discourse about this new version of NAPLAN and exactly what it means for our students in the weeks to come. Let's move on to our first regular feature now. And on the subject of marking and giving feedback to students, Stephen Culber is back to share some of his various strategies for mixing up giving feedback to students. So here is Stephen Culber discussing ways to mix up feedback for students in Culber's Corner.
People. Again, we're looking at thinking about marking, assessment, workload, how we can try and streamline the way that we approach things a tiny little bit. And so this one is less pedagogically focused. So, you know, keep your teaching the way it is. Don't change anything necessarily. As I will invariably repeat far too often, I'm an English teacher. The only thing you can trust an English teacher to do is be able to mark massive piles of essays, extended pieces of writing, and do it quickly and efficiently. And so, unfortunately, the nature of the beast is that that's in some respects unavoidable. So previously I've spoken about, you know, getting programs to read things out loud. Today we'll be looking at different ways you can provide feedback to students. And again, feedback, of course, is unavoidable. There is a lot of it. And so for me as an English teacher, these perhaps are less about ways to smooth out your workload, but at least a small attempt at making it slightly more interesting, which is, as a 12th year English teacher, something that's very important to me. So I'm hoping that you, as a teacher of whatever it is that you teach to whatever group of students or ages you teach, some of these things might be worth trying out, if for no other reason than to mix things up a tiny little bit. So the obvious type of written feedback is written feedback, tick, cross, circle. I'm personally a very firm believer that we do not tick, we do not cross, we do not circle spelling mistakes. Maybe that makes me a member of the new school, I'm not sure. But that's never something I've done, and that's probably something I will survive my whole career never doing, because I just don't think there's any bang for the buck. I've never seen any student at any level sit down with a piece of writing that's been ticked, crossed, circled, question marked, underlined, whatever it is, and gone through it meticulously looking for their own errors in the level of detail that you would hope would be occurring if you were spending your time doing that. Sometimes I'll hit a piece of writing with a couple of ticks as I go through because I think, oh, that's good. And that'll remind me to take a photo of that or to show that to the other students. So, you know, typically take a photo of it, put it up on a PowerPoint or somewhere similar so that we can look at best practice examples. Another way to approach marking is to do the same thing, but to do it on with a stylus enabled device. So whether it's, you know, OneNote, Google Doc, Word, whatever it is, get your little stylus out, press the markup button, pick a rainbow pen, do something, find the most interesting way you can to do what is in essence, the exact same thing that you're doing on a written piece of paper, but you're doing it digitally, and for some reason, for some short amount of time, that feels slightly different. And you can trick your brain into thinking, hey, I'm not just doing the exact same thing, this is slightly different, and I'm learning something new, which is unfortunately not the case. In some respects, trick ourselves into doing it. Another way you can give feedback is to record audio. And so the important part here, since we're focusing on workload and streamlining processes, is that you're working natively in whatever format you're working in. So, you know, if you have an LMS of any particular kind, obviously if it doesn't have an audio feedback option, don't do it. If it requires you to work across multiple devices, you know, record audio on a microphone or a phone and then transfer it, that's straight away far too many steps. If your students have done the work in, Word, you can dictate perhaps as an alternative, click dictate, speak what you wanted to say. Again, you're essentially still doing the work, but you're doing it in a slightly different mode in a manner that could, you know, be novel for at least a short amount of time. Another way you can do it, and this is probably for more important pieces of work, you can do a screen recording or a short video. Screen recording is probably best in this case, because then you can be looking at the student's work, scrolling through it, circling things. Again, that's of course only a high yield option if you know that the student's going to watch the video for starters, but also if you know they're going to go through it in the level of meticulous detail you would expect if you're wasting your time doing a video. And again, the important part is not that it's highly produced or anything of that nature, but rather that you can be talking, speaking, writing, using a stylus, whatever it is, pointing at things as you do it. So rather than, you know, typing out written explanation, doing what we know about good instructional design, you're actually pointing the students towards the thing you want them to focus on. And then obviously the classic, the most grown-up seeming one is, you know, click track changes, write some comments on a digital document, and really give the students the impression that they're doing highly important work that's getting marked up in Word in and of itself. So just to run back through them, you can do it the old-fashioned way in a written form. Use a stylus, record an audio clip of you explaining what you liked, what you didn't like, what bits were interesting. Do a video recording or a screen recording to show those sort of visual elements to combine with your spoken feedback. You can use dictate as a way to speak into words, basically. And obviously, the fanciest, most grown-up form is track changes, which assumes that students know how to, you know, accept and do all those clever things that many students do not. So until next time, keep reading, keep writing, keep learning.
And that was Stephen Kolber with Kolber's Corner. You can find him on Twitter at Stephen_Kolber or look for the link to his profile in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. On to our next regular segment, and Tom Marnie is here to discuss a foundational document in Australian educational policy that, since its inception in 2019, seems to have been largely missing from educational discourse. So here now is Tom Marnie with Ideology in Education.
Welcome to Ideology in Education. Have you heard of the Alice Springs and Bantwa Education Declaration? Now, if you haven't, don't feel too bad, because it doesn't seem to have really come up in any educational discourse since its creation. For some context, the Mbantwa Declaration was signed off in 2019 by all education and state education ministers, including the federal government, setting out the vision for Australian education and a commitment to see improved educational outcomes in Australia. But the thing is, this supposedly foundational document that sets out the vision for Australian education has largely been unmentioned since its creation in 2019. Our new Education Minister, Jason Clare, hasn't referenced this statement at all. And the last time we really heard a politician referencing our visions and aims for education was probably back in 2021 when we had Alan Tudge as Federal Education Minister. Alan Tudge used the declaration to claim that we weren't meeting our aims of providing a world-class education, which essentially started his whole crusade, I guess, against the Australian curriculum to impose a few particular visions for Australian history into the history curriculum, among other things. So this lack of reference to the visions of Australian education through the Alice Springs Education Declaration could just be a result of people not being aware of it. But in this episode of Ideology and Education, I want to just put forward that maybe it's due to the fact that there are actually some core tensions that surround some of the core visions for Australian education within this document that are actually a bit hard to reconcile. The Alice Springs Education Declaration states, and I'm quoting here, "Our vision is for a world-class education system that encourages and supports every student to be the very best they can be, no matter where they live or what kind of learning challenges they may face." In this episode, I just want to put forward that these two core visions, the first one, to have a world-class education system, and two, to support every student to be the very best they can be, are actually in direct conflict with one another in many ways in our current education system. I'd like to further explore how these differences arise from the ideological foundations inherent within these visions. And maybe then we can make some speculation as to why there is a lack of reference to this supposedly foundational document in Australian education. So in this episode, I thought it might be worth just exploring what it might mean for Australia to have a world-class education system, and also to have a look at what it might mean for an education system that supports every student to be the very best they can be, and then to have a look at some of those ideological conflicts between those two assumptions, those two visions for Australian education, and then maybe see what we can do with that. So firstly, what might it mean for Australia to have a world-class education system? Now, if you've heard of the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is often referred to as OECD, they've grown in power globally over the last 20 years or so, and have basically sent countries into panics and crises, wanting to ensure they don't fall too far below on ladders and league tables for what's called the Programme for International Student Achievement, or PISA, scores. So currently, from a policy perspective, the quality of an education system now is largely determined by the OECD published PISA results. If you're not aware of what PISA is, it's basically a standardized test that focuses on performance in a pretty narrow curriculum of reading, mathematics, and science skills. The OECD even boasts themselves that over the past two decades, PISA has become the world's premier yardstick for comparing quality, equity, and efficiency in learning outcomes across countries, and an influential force for education reform. So as a result of this, countries have essentially been pitted in direct competition with one another, with their PISA results being publicly released, scrutinized, and judged, and ready for anyone to have a look at and make judgments based on those, and make value judgments based on that. Now, we've seen over the past 10 or so years that Australian governments have continued to focus on these measurements as a gauge of the quality of our education system as a whole, and in particular, referencing to other countries. So more recently, that's resulted in calls by Alan Tudge to push Australia back into the group of top-performing nations, or more recently, these results have been used to push an evidence-based agenda. Now, as a result of these PISA publications and these league tables, Australian education has then been labelled as failing to achieve its goal of a world-class education based on where our position is. So if our position is low, it means we're failing. So if we were to summarise that, it seems that what we can say when we're talking about a world-class education system is that Australia is outperforming other countries on these international league tables. So it's to win and have other countries lose in a game of global competitiveness. Now let's have a closer look at what it might mean for education to support every student to be the very best they can be. Now, this call mirrors others that are within the Alice Springs Education Declaration that claims that young Australians are at the centre of the declaration. Now, it's quite a vague statement, and throughout this Education Declaration, there are a few ways maybe we can interpret what this means specifically. And the Education Declaration states, and I'm quoting here, our Australian education must prepare young people to thrive in a time of rapid social and technological change and complex environmental, social, and economic challenges. Now, it's further claimed that education plays a vital role in promoting the intellectual, physical, social, emotional, moral, spiritual, and aesthetic development and well-being of young Australians. Wow. Seems like a lot. And if you think it is a lot, well, I think I'd agree with you. But if we could boil this whole thing down about what it might mean to support every student to be the very best they can be, what we might be able to interpret here is that Australian education should provide our young people with opportunities for them to have freedom for how they might engage with the world, not just in terms of what career path they might choose, but we're talking moral dimensions, ethical dimensions as well. Now to talk about some of the ideological differences between these two statements. As we've looked at the world-class education system, what we're doing when we're saying we want to have a world-class education system is we're saying we want to be on the top of these league tables. We're essentially buying into performative dimensions of what's called a neoliberal ideology. I've talked about this ideology in past episodes. Feel free to go back to those to listen further about what neoliberal ideology entails and how we might describe it. But basically, when we're talking about neoliberalism, we're talking about marketization, consumerism, deregulation, that sort of thing. And those are assumed to correlate with quality. Now, on the other hand, to support every student to be the very best they can be implies a connection with more progressive ideologies that value the individuality of young people, and for them to uniquely explore and learn from and exist in the world. We can see a tension here between these two ways of thinking about education, because there's one that's fundamentally tied to performance, whereas the other is fundamentally a matter of existence. Now, the issue between these two visions is that good performance doesn't always correlate with a good existence. And we could even say there are times where a good existence might even require poor performance, less efficiency, and less effectiveness. Now, world-class education, as it currently is understood in educational discourse, as I've just talked about, in no way does it guarantee the moral, ethical, and spiritual individual that's hoped for in the Alice Springs Education Declaration. If anything, we've seen a focus on these international league tables distract politicians, policymakers, and teachers from engaging with the important moral work of education, which has become increasingly replaced by effective and efficient strategies to improve learning and performance as the goal of education. So in this episode, what I've tried to do is try and highlight some of the tensions that arise from those two visions within the Alice Springs Education Declaration. The first one to have a world-class education system, and the second to support every student to be the very best they can be. Now, I've tried to highlight some of the ideological differences within the foundations of these perspectives and visions of education, and maybe this explains some of the disappearance in reference to the Mbantwa Agreement in educational discourse. Because these are difficult tensions to talk about, and maybe that is the reason that instead of looking at the holistic vision of Australian education, we focused maybe, or politicians have focused mainly on one side of the coin, which is the competitive side. So I've tried to show how maybe marrying these two aims might not be as easy as it seems, and sometimes we might need to actually forfeit some of those policies to develop a world-class education in order to support every student to be the best, very best they can be. But then again, maybe it doesn't explain anything. But I hope that it raises the important question for you as a teacher as how you might be able to engage in what we could consider the highly contextual work of supporting young Australians to be the very best they can be within a policy context that's just so caught up in performance agendas to become world class. I wonder if you've ever experienced this tension between these core aims in your own teaching practice. The push to be more and more efficient and more effective in your practice, but then also trying to balance that with the slow work of actually engaging in relationships with your students and making an impactful difference in the moral, spiritual, and responsible characters that you are shaping in your practice. If you've got some interesting stories you wanted to share in relation to this, or you wanted to chat further, please reach out, send me a message on Twitter, or send me an email. Otherwise, till next time, take care.
And that was Tom Marnie with Ideology in Education. You can find him on Twitter at TomMarnieEDU or look for the link to his profile in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. It's time now for Education in the News. And as I said at the beginning, what I'd like to focus on in this episode is the election happening in New South Wales on Saturday the 25th of March. It is the New South Wales state election, and I want to look at the role that education is playing in the election policies of particularly the major parties vying to either make government or to have a significant influence over the new government. So I'll be primarily looking at the coalition of the New South Wales Liberals and National Party, looking at the New South Wales Labor Party's policies as they are offering themselves as an alternative government, and looking at the parties of the New South Wales Greens. Now, I just want to note also, there is a new political party offering themselves for election in this ballot, and that is the New South Wales Public Education Party. And full disclosure, I am a member of this party. They have formed out of a coalition of previously minor single-issue parties, what used to also be the Science Party or the Reason Party, and they've all come together with an agreement that what vehicle in society primarily served their interests, being that they were a group of parties that were devoted to issues of scientific literacy and of reasonable policy making and rational thinking, they all came together under the understanding that public education was the primary vehicle through which we try to achieve those goals in our society. And so the Public Education Party has formed and are working to hopefully achieve maybe a seat in the upper house of New South Wales. So for people who have a strong interest in education, if you are an issues voter for whom education is one of your deciding factors, you might want to check out the Public Education Party. That being said, for this episode, I'm primarily going to look at, as I said, the New South Wales Coalition, the Labor Party, and the Greens, and look at what they are offering as their influence in education. Before I do that, I just want to give a quick bit of context to the state of education in New South Wales going into this election. Now, the current coalition government were first voted into power in 2011 in what Anthony Green, the ABC's election analyst, described as the single biggest swing in election history. The former Labor Party had, I think, so thoroughly distanced itself from the voting public. There had been so many corruption scandals. It was the era of Joe Tripodi and Eddie Obeid and their corruption scandals that had, I think, thoroughly turned people away from the Labor Party and the Labor brand. And in 2011, it was, as I said, the single biggest swing in Australian election history that gave an incoming coalition government unprecedented control over policy and politics in New South Wales. And one of the first things they did was make significant changes to industrial relations law as it relates to public sector workers. And one of the policy changes made way back in 2011, which is today a major discussion point and a major point of disagreement between the Coalition and the Labor Party going into this election was the public sector wages cap. Back 12 years ago, the government changed industrial law in New South Wales so that the law was subservient to Liberal Party policy. It was a move that was widely criticised as being undemocratic or even anti-democratic, but in effect, the IRC, the Industrial Relations Commission, the what used to be referred to as the independent umpire, I don't know if anybody refers to them as independent anymore, but they had their ability to decide public sector wage cases limited by Liberal Party policy. And that Liberal Party policy said that public sector wages could not be increased any more than 2.5% in any given year. Now, that is significant, and the reason that still has an effect today is that that 2.5% has been significantly below inflation for quite a number of years, which means that teachers' salaries in relation to the cost of living and even in relation to other sectors where salaries have done a better job of keeping pace with inflation, teachers are increasingly underpaid when compared to other aspects of society. This has led to teaching and education in New South Wales now. The dominant media narrative around education in New South Wales at the moment is that of crisis. There is particularly a workforce crisis, an inability to recruit and retain teachers in sufficient numbers to staff all of the schools in New South Wales. In an effort to pour a little bit of water on the story of a workforce crisis, Education Minister Sarah Mitchell said recently that nearly half or just over half of all schools in New South Wales had no vacancies, which of course was a tacit admission that approximately half or just under half of all schools in New South Wales had at least one full-time vacancy, if not more. And particularly in rural and remote parts of New South Wales, they are struggling to get an adequate number of teachers and particularly struggling to get adequately qualified teachers for some specialist areas like mathematics, sciences, some technical fields. But it's not just the rural and remote parts of the state where this is happening. Also schools in some of the more affluent parts of the state are struggling to attract teachers because teachers cannot afford to live anywhere near the schools that need teachers to work. When the median house price in Sydney has been over $1 million for some time, a teacher on a salary of slightly over $100,000, and that's the top of the teaching scale in New South Wales, just a bit over $100,000. The idea of a young teacher being able to save the necessary deposit or have any chance of buying a house is basically not economically feasible, and especially at the moment as we are facing a national rental crisis with a rapid rise in interest rates. Renting properties in many of these places is as expensive, if not more expensive, than servicing a mortgage. And so it is simply not possible for teachers to live within a reasonable commuting distance of some schools. And so, you know, there was a story published just the day this episode goes online, just the morning of the 15th. I saw a story about a public school offering large cash bonuses for teachers of particular fields because they were so desperate and so incapable of getting a teacher to teach particular HSC subjects. So going into this election, the narrative is crisis, and it is impossible to separate the idea of education being in crisis from 12 years of the government that has been managing it. And so the government have for a little while now been trying to change that narrative, there's been a lot of talk, for example, anyone who pays attention to the media in education in New South Wales will have seen the minister over the last 12 to 18 months make a number of announcements. We have saved teachers minutes of work a week, which often don't get the kind of reaction that I think they're hoping for because, you know, unless you're going to be able to say, well, actually, we've made a significant reduction overall, or we've managed to make huge improvements systemically, most people look at that and say, well, that's not really an effective achievement. Certainly the narrative on social media has been quite dismissive of those claims. So what I'm going to do for this segment, and I appreciate this might run a little bit longer than usual for our education in the news, is we're going to take a look now at what the major political parties are offering for education in their election platform. And I'm going to start with the New South Wales Liberal Party, who make up the majority of the government as it currently stands. And they have on their website, if you go to newsouthwalesliberal.org.au, they have a subheading, Our Plan. And under that, there is the section Delivering World-Class Education. Now, one thing to be noted after a quick scan of this website is it is notably lacking on specific details on how much money is to be spent on things or how much of the budget is actually going to be allocated to some of these announcements. So in the past, there have been, you know, both parties have in the past put up some very detailed costings, and it seems that this time around, certainly the government is going for a much more, shall we say, narrative approach, just talking in relatively short, aspirational terms about what they hope to achieve. So the first subheading under Our Plan is talking about the best start to education. Probably the single biggest costing announcement, or would have the biggest underlying costs. They say they're going to introduce a full additional year of free play-based education before kindergarten. Now, it'll be interesting. Again, it's lacking in details here. It'll be interesting to see whether this is a continuation of subsidies to private preschool providers or whether it will be entirely public service delivery. The second paragraph does say that they're going to include investments in attracting and retaining early childhood teachers and educators to help integrate preschool with the larger school system in Australia, but doesn't commit. It stops short of committing to, say, every public school having a pre-K class included, for example. The next subheading they have is improving classroom behaviour. Now, this has been a Liberal Party policy and talking point for the last couple of years. We heard about it quite a bit under the former federal coalition government under Alan Tudge and then Stuart Robert when he was relieving minister. There's only two short sentences saying they want to support better learning by improving the classroom environment. They say that a new chief behaviour officer will be appointed in 2023. So I guess this website hasn't been updated since they appointed one, which was something that happened earlier this year, and that they're going to be supported by 200 behaviour specialists in the public high school system. Now, that means there will be one behaviour specialist for every 24 schools, I think, 23 schools, 24 schools. So that will be interesting to see just what kind of effect that spreading of staff will be. The next talking point is engaging parents, that they're saying they know a lot of parents want to be more engaged in their child's education, which is why they're going to make it easier by sending parents a copy of the curriculum at the start of each year. And for parents of high school students, this will include a list of texts for key learning areas. Now, obviously this is an editorial podcast. I really want to run the warning flag up the pole on this one. This sounds very much like the policy proposal made by One Nation a couple of years ago, Mark Latham, who used to be the former federal Labor leader and is now the Australian representative of One Nation in New South Wales. He proposed this policy as a kind of anti-wokeism strategy. He wanted parents to have the curriculum a full year in advance, and he wanted parents to have the ability to withdraw their children from any lesson whose content they didn't agree with. Now, this announcement by the Liberal Party stops short of saying that they will allow parents to have that degree of control, of withdrawing their children. But when they say, when this announcement says that they want to send parents a copy of the curriculum, now, technically, the curriculum is the syllabus documents. However, this goes further than that, saying a list of texts for key learning areas. And that's the part that becomes a bit problematic. You know, if you've taught, you know, I'm an English teacher in New South Wales. We have a lot of discretion over what texts are taught to what group of students. And I can tell you, it's not something that happens without contention, particularly in this increasing, you know, we live in an age of increasing culture wars where, unfortunately, we are borrowing a lot of education rhetoric from the United States, where, you know, in the state of Florida, they have passed legislation basically banning books that have any reference to genders and sexualities other than white heterosexual people, or at least that's the intention of the law. I don't think the law is actually written that way. But this is a policy that is going to provide tools to the culture warriors to accuse schools of indoctrination, of, you know, trying to, you know, I'm not even going to go into the speculation over what it might be used to accuse of. I have already in my professional career seen firsthand examples of this affecting schools, where the existence of LGBT characters in a text, the existence of LGBT characters in text has been a cause for complaint. And this particular policy seems only to exacerbate that idea. And the one thing about it is a direct and deliberate erosion of trust of the teacher's judgment, and not just the teacher's judgment, the school's judgment. Like, a classroom teacher is several orders of decision-making authority down the ladder before, you know, after the head teacher, after the deputy, after the principal. But this is really placing not a target, but placing classroom teachers more and more in the spotlight for the decisions made in the class, whether those decisions are up to the teacher or not. So that's just, you know, as I said, running a bit of a warning flag up the pole, because this policy resonates very strongly with what Mark Latham from One Nation proposed, and it is hard to see how this will serve a positive engagement for parents rather than just, as I said, putting ammunition in the hands of the culture warriors. The other part of engaging parents is that they are starting a parent advocacy team, an independent team within the department to provide an alternative avenue to help parents and students get the resolution they need when disagreements cannot be resolved at the school level. This has been referred to in the media as like an alternate complaints handling process, kind of like an independent ombudsman for parents that have a grievance with a school to go beyond the school's borders or beyond the school gates to get that complaint heard. Much more detail needed about that. On the website, it is literally one sentence. After those items, we finally get to more teachers in the classroom. They say they're going to continue to create more ways to entice people in other professions to become teachers, continuing the policies that they've been working on for the last few years, which have not met with any great success. And they say they will be getting more teachers in the classroom with their plan to introduce a 1 year's master qualification for aspiring high school teachers. So basically a flagship policy of their own government of making teaching a minimum master's requirement, they are now offering to undo. Interesting. Finally, better rewards for the best teachers. This has been an announcement already made where they're talking about offering not exactly performance pay, but offering a limited number of high paid positions connected to the accreditation process. Here in New South Wales, and I know this happens in many states and territories now, where there is an option to take a more highly paid position if you get accredited at a highly accomplished or lead teacher level. The New South Wales government have for a while been planning to extend that, and they've been talking about, you know, $150,000 positions for teachers. Of course, the number of positions are limited, and the criteria for who will be eligible to get them has not yet been made clear. It's a policy that has been criticised as being highly divisive because many people say that if you make teaching a competitive profession, you will have a huge negative impact on the collegiality and collaboration that is necessary for schools to function effectively. And again, I have observed competitive cultures having a dire effect on education, especially when people believe they are vying for a promotions position or for some other limited position. And that has been one of the big criticisms, again, leveled at this announcement. Next subheading is more intensive learning support. And this is the only policy announcement to actually have a dollar figure attached to it, where they're not talking primarily about what they're going to do. They're talking about how much they've spent up till now. The government have invested $700 million in COVID intensive learning support programs, employing 15,000 teachers. They say they're going to continue that program for another year at the cost of another $250 million. So those are the policies that the Liberal Party are taking into the election. On the subject of the teacher workforce crisis, it could basically be summarized as more of what we've already been doing, plus some extra highly paid teachers and removing professional qualification requirements. For me, reading that policy platform, the biggest concern I have is that engaging parents subheading of publishing the curriculum a year in advance, because this announcement lacks details, and the only version of this that I've seen a detailed proposal of, which was the Mark Latham policy, required potentially individual lesson plans to be published up to a year in advance. So forgetting the fact that that is just a terrible educational practice, because you cannot respond to the needs of students and their strengths and areas for development if you are locked into lesson plans written a year in ahead, lacking the context of your class. It is, as I said, only likely to provide ammunition for the increasingly divisive culture war politics that we find ourselves surrounded by. I also think the lack of details is a concern. Nothing in that webpage included links to allow you to go to look at more details or provide more costings. And that lack of detail really allows a government to kind of skirt accountability, because they can't be sort of held accountable to not delivering on a promise if they don't really make a particularly detailed promise. And sorry, there is one thing about their election platform that I neglected to mention. In the middle of all of that text, absent any real context, is just a list of suburbs in which the title says building the schools to stay ahead. So it suggests that these are the schools that they're going to commit to building. Again, no details, no timelines, no clear indication of whether these will be fully funded public schools or whether the government plans to do public-private partnerships, which has been their model of operation for some time now for building new facilities, or even potentially supporting non-government sector institutions to build schools in those areas. But they do have a block in the middle of their text, and it's not even text, it's an image. Somebody has taken a screenshot from another source, and it just sort of sits in the middle of the web page, devoid of any context and in a formatting and appearance different to the rest of the page. It's a little bit odd. Anyhow, let's move on now to have a look at the Australian Labor Party, or the New South Wales Labor Party one. And they have a web page called Labor's Fresh Start Plan for Education. And they do mention TAFE explicitly and specifically. TAFE has always been a big part of the Labor Party platform. It is notably absent from the government's platform. And their policy webpage has 9 key subheadings, 9 key sectors, each of which you can click through to read a little bit more detail. So each one has like a page, or at least a press release, I guess. The first of those is a commitment to 100 new preschools. So they are committing to build 100 public preschools that are co-located with government primary schools, and they're saying they will do this in the first term of government. So they say this will cost approximately $3.8 billion for their entire package of early childhood learning initiatives. And unlike the government's platform, they are talking specifically about preschools built as part of local government primary schools within the public network. So a bit more detail there. And they do connect this preschool plan to the idea of education outcomes declining over the last 12 years. And this will provide people, provide young people a better opportunity to be ready to engage with schooling. The next subheading is more preschools at non-government schools. So they're extending beyond just public preschools and saying that they will also put $60 million into new and expanded preschools that are co-located at non-government schools. So we can only assume that they're talking about Catholic systemic schools or independent primary schools, but as well as 100 preschools at public schools, they're going to build, and they say, at least 50 non-government or preschools at non-government schools. Given that the average ratio of students attending public schools to non-government schools is about 2 to 1, so about 66% of students go to a government school, about 34% go to a non-government school. This policy announcement basically reflects that split, so they're going to build 100 preschools at government schools, at least 50 at non-government schools, meaning that wherever people choose to send their kids, they'll have access to that additional preschool. The next page is new public schools in high growth areas. And it just has one sentence. New South Wales Labor will build new public schools in high growth areas across New South Wales, and then lists 7 suburbs where new public schools will be built. Now, that graphic that I mentioned in the Liberal Party page had close to, I think, about 70 schools or 70 areas listed where schools were to be built. The Labor page has 7, and each of the names on that list links to a more detailed media release, basically, about where those schools will be built. So, again, commitment to build public schools, but on a much smaller number, servicing so-called high-growth areas. The next policy point is 10,000 additional permanent teachers. Now, this stands in contrast to the Liberal Party's supposed 15,000. And this policy seemed, these two policies seem very similar, where they seem to be primarily about shifting teachers currently in temporary positions into permanent roles. So whether or not it's creating an additional 10,000 teachers on top of current supply, thereby potentially reducing workloads or other things, does not seem to be the case. Instead, it seems to be offering job security to teachers currently in temporary appointments when a permanent position may be available. They identify job insecurity as a major cause of teacher attrition, and this is offered as an alternative or offered as a potential solution to those attrition rates. The next page is simply entitled Scrap the Wages Cap. And the headline says, New South Wales Labor will abolish the Liberal National Government's wages cap, which has been a handbrake on productivity. Now, it's interesting to note that only the day before this episode went online, there was a leaders' debate between Chris Minns of the Labor Party and Dominic Perrottet, the current Premier. And on the discussion of the public sector wages cap, Chris Minns refused to confirm or commit to whether this would mean that public sector workers would be actually in line for further pay rises, just that they would scrap the policy-based cap. So there's some potential details unsaid or unspoken in this announcement. This is one of the shortest pages in their policy announcement. It's just a headline and two sentences. The next page is entitled Slash Admin Burden on Teachers. And they talk about beginning with a line-by-line audit of teachers' administrative workloads. And they identify in this policy announcement that teachers and schools are subject to 219 policy documents requiring them to enforce compliance within a range of policies, and that they want to reduce that. They say that full-time teachers are working on average 150% of their contracted hours, or 60.1 hours per week, according to the December 21 Australian Teacher Workforce Report, and that they want to reduce that. This is one of those policies and discussion points that's been around for a while in all political spheres, and I honestly think it significantly misses the mark. Forgive me a moment of editorializing. Yes, there are a lot of policies and compliance requirements. Yes, I'm sure that will be a welcome relief. But the majority of teacher workload still comes from the fact that teachers in Australia, particularly New South Wales, teach more of their job working hours as face-to-face teaching than a majority of other systems around the world. And when we, you know, when we often see our system compared to, say, Singapore, for example, and one side of politics particularly loves to use Singapore as a comparison because they often have class sizes well in excess of our national average of 30. But what they don't like to talk about is how much less face-to-face teaching time the teachers in Singapore do. And the results through PISA, the surveys through PISA, have long said that teachers' face-to-face teaching time is a bigger factor than necessarily class size, because teachers who can plan effective lessons and give effective evaluation and feedback, who have the time to do that, might be better, you know, might be better able to account for certain numbers of students. That's what some of the data has shown. So this idea of addressing policy and compliance, I'm sure it'll be welcome. I'm sure there'll be improvements to be made there. But what we still do not see anybody talking about in terms of teacher workload is the simple reality of the number of face-to-face hours that teachers have and the lack of time for planning, assessment, reporting, and administrative and compliance practices that is factored into the working day. And that is especially true of primary schools where, you know, teachers are given 2 hours a week during the school day to actually do any kind of administrative work. Otherwise, it falls entirely to, you know, those hours before and after school. And as this policy announcement says, most teachers find themselves working 60 plus hours a week. The next policy page is the $400 million Education Future Fund. And they say they want to end the historic underfunding of public schools by creating a $400 million Education Future Fund, as well as a permanent and ongoing literacy and numeracy tutoring program. So there's a lot of talk in this about what previous think tanks have said and some stats and figures about where schools are in terms of their schooling resource standard. It says that $400 million will be enough to bring schools up to 95% of the schooling resource standard, which is still less than 100%, it should be noted. But again, this is the only major announcement on overall systemic funding for education that we see. And there was certainly nothing of this nature in the Liberal Party policy. It's, again, there's a lot more information on this page, but not a lot of detail about exactly what it will look like, what the outcomes are expected to be. But at least it is putting school funding back on the table to a degree and making a commitment to improve the current state of school funding. On to the second last policy page, and perhaps one of the more controversial, which is that Chris Minns, as Labor leader, has committed to a statewide mobile phone ban in New South Wales public high school classrooms. So the issue of phone bans has been a hot topic in the media and around the country. We know that South Australia have implemented a statewide phone ban. We know that individual schools in New South Wales have implemented similar phone bans, and the Labor Party are promising to make this statewide policy. Now, in this policy announcement, they talk about declining PISA results and where New South Wales ranks in the country and in PISA for maths, sciences, suggesting by connection that this phone ban will help improve those results. But again, doesn't really go into great detail. It does bring up one of my favorite little talking points in education discourse, which is the fact that early in PISA, Australia, and particularly New South Wales, were ranked in the top 10 in the world for most of the major areas. It says we were ranked 6th in reading, 9th in maths, and 3rd in science. And okay, sure, in 2006, smartphones had not yet become common property. The first iPhone, I think, was launched in 2007. But also back then, teacher salaries were much more comparable to other professions. NAPLAN didn't exist. We didn't have a national curriculum or accreditation levels that teachers had to do work to maintain. You know, there were so many other big systemic changes that have been made since 2006. And to suggest that phones alone are the contributing factor, or that banning phones alone will somehow get us back to the magical world of the early 2000s in terms of educational attainment, seems a little bit disingenuous. But that's the narrative, and that's, I suppose, everybody wants an easy scapegoat. I'm not saying that banning phones won't potentially make a difference or won't make some improvements, but I don't believe it alone is the panacea for these issues. And that brings us to the final education policy announcement, which is manufacturing centres of excellence. And this is where they say they're going to establish TAFE, domestic manufacturing centres of excellence, to help rebuild TAFE and our state's domestic manufacturing capacity and capabilities. They commit to facilities able to take on 1,000 apprentices and workers a year. They talk about it costing $42.7 million to upgrade and fit out 3 facilities. And this announcement, I suppose, really just highlights exactly what we lost in the destruction of the TAFE system over the last decade. And I dare say we are going to be feeling those reductions in our skilled labour force for decades, if not generations, to come. So this is one small commitment to try and reverse that damage. It'll be interesting to see just what sort of impact it actually has. So there you have the Labour Party education policy platform. A lot more detail, a lot more costings, a lot more focus on the public system and public provision. Still a few things of questionable value, some of which, like the phone ban, which will probably resonate with parents more than it will with students and educators. But that's the world, again, that we live in, and we'll have to wait and see, A, if that policy goes ahead, B, if it does have any effect, and finally, whether or not other changes are made to address some of the issues connected to, you know, phones and distractibility, and, you know, one issue that neither party still wants to talk about, and that has been brought up repeatedly, particularly by the authors of Waiting for Gonski, is that fact that we have one of the most segregated education systems in the country that gets increasingly segregated along socioeconomic lines. And we know that that concentration of disadvantage is itself an extended disadvantage. Yet there is no mention of anything to try and address the segregation of schools. If anything, both parties are announcing policies that will continue to feed into it, particularly, you know, funding the provision of preschools in non-government schools, allowing people to continue to choose to segregate their children as part of the education system. That, you know, those are the big picture policy issues that we see completely absent from either party's policy at this point in time. And before I move on, I just want to make one other little interesting observation about the Labour Party website and how traffic is managed. If you go to the actual New South Wales Labour page, they have a link and a subheading for their Fresh Start plan, which includes Labour's Fresh Start plan for education. That takes you to a separate website. So you go from New South Wales Labour to freshstartplan.com.au when you click on that link. And that page has those nine heading areas that I mentioned or that I've just spoken about. But when you click on the details for each of those nine areas, it takes you to Chris Minns's personal website where the information on those policies is contained. So it's interesting to see that they are even directing web traffic towards the party leader rather than it being part of the Labor Party's web presence. I'm sure there is some reason of either web hosting or marketing or just being able to boast about traffic that is behind that, but it just seems a little bit odd that their major policy announcements are hosted solely on an MP's personal website. And finally, let's now go and look at the Greens policy platform for education. And similar to what Labor have done, the Greens have a lot of their information on education on the website Greens for Ballina, which is the website of Tamara Smith, the Greens MP for Ballina, who is their public education spokesperson or their education spokesperson. And again, if you go through it, if you click through the Greens website or look for information, you'll end up on Tamara Smith's Greens for Ballina page. So the Greens are not expected to make government in their own, but they do often get enough seats either in the upper house or the lower house to have an influence on legislation and policy. And so we'll look at their policies as well, because this may be a significant influencing direction on education policy in a new government. They've got five key headings: to make education free, to put schools first, to restore TAFE, to provide universal public preschool, and to grow New South Wales universities. So when they talk about schools first, this is a policy that goes to the issues of teacher recruitment and retention and the provision of public education around the state. And they want to immediately raise teachers' salaries 15%, give additional hours of relief from face-to-face teaching, make sure that all schools are funded to 100% of the schooling resource standard, develop a workforce plan to recruit and retrain 12,000 new teachers over 10 years. So they are explicitly talking about additional teachers. One that's really interesting here is getting rid of demountable classrooms if they've been in operation for more than 3 years and invest in $1 billion in school maintenance backlog. And that's another thing in New South Wales that doesn't get talked about as much as it used to, is the fact that a significant number of public schools in New South Wales are getting to the point where they need major maintenance or may not be sound. And, you know, it's hard to talk about because nobody wants to talk about education as being a deficit or being in deficit, but we have a lot of aging school buildings that do need support, and there is a massive backlog on building maintenance that has just not been funded for a long time. They want to provide an additional school counsellor for every public school in New South Wales and reach a target of one counsellor per 500 students. Interesting to note, mental health support not mentioned by either of the two major parties. And they want to provide additional resources and funding for free public school breakfasts and lunches to cover all excursions and other individual student costs. So basically removing a lot of the incidental and secondary costs from school, such as meals and extracurricular excursions. Their next heading is restoring TAFE. They want to once again make TAFE free for all students. And speaking of the destruction of TAFE, you know, if you're not familiar, one of the big policies that the New South Wales Liberals implemented was to make TAFE a competitively funded system, whereas before it had been a publicly funded system, which meant that the cost of doing a course or an apprenticeship suddenly went from being a few thousand dollars of a subsidised course to students having to take out loans comparable to doing a bachelor's degree at university. So, you know, some students were racking up $20,000, $30,000 debts to do their apprenticeship, which, you know, there's an argument to be made, well, if it's training for a job or whatever, but that was also the backbone of a lot of shady operators signing people up for courses that didn't exist to take out loans that people couldn't afford to repay, because under the HECS and HELP system, you don't have to repay it until you are earning over a certain threshold. And that was how under that deregulation of TAFE, something like, I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but I think the TAFE loans budget went from something like less than $1 billion, I think it was about $800,000 a year, up to $4 billion. And a lot of that money was just pocketed by shady operators who then took the money and ran out of the country. There were efforts to claim some of it back through the courts, but they were not hugely successful, is my recollection. Anyhow, they want to make TAFE free again for all students. They want to deliver a salary increase for TAFE teachers that is on par with school teachers. They want to provide pathways to permanency for 10,000 casual TAFE teachers over the next 4 years, reduce administrative burdens, abolish the contestable funding model, which is what I was just talking about, and guarantee 100% of all state and federal vocational education budgets, and to stop closing TAFE campuses. Of course, that was the other thing about the deregulation of TAFE in New South Wales. Where there used to be campuses that had the facilities for classes of students to do construction, electrical, whatever. You know, I did a diploma in live theatre production in a place that had a small working theatre, so you could do your light rigging, your sound systems and whatever else. A lot of those disappeared. A lot of that land was sold off either to developers or to private operators and replaced with shopfront and online services. I do not want someone doing the electrical work in my house who has mainly been trained on an iPad. You know, I want them to have the opportunity to practice wiring lights regularly, frequently, to minimize the risk of something going wrong. So that idea of closing TAFE campuses is a big one. Then they talk about universal public preschool. They say they want to ensure free and universal preschool by 2030. They want to deliver 100 new government preschools in the next 3 years. They want to increase before and after school care and remove privatization incentives. And as I mentioned before, you know, when we talk about the funding model for preschool, current government policies are about providing subsidies to private providers, not providing a public service. And so that's something that the Greens want to tackle directly. And finally, they talk about wanting to grow universities, where they want to wipe student debt, return funding to universities, and disallow privatization of the tertiary sector, work towards acquisition of private student housing, stop the sell-off of university-owned student housing, ensure transparent and specific reporting on staff numbers, wages, and employment status, put caps on executive salaries, reject casualization, and restore secure ongoing employment, ensure university colleges are safe and meet the housing needs of all students, keep universities independent from political interference, and overhaul university governance and reporting requirements to ensure transparency and staff involvement in decision-making. So that's the Greens education platform summed up. Now, a lack of detail, a lack of costing for most of those. One of the comments often made about Greens policies is that because they are not a party that's ever going to form government in their own right, at least not in the near future, they get to make these hugely aspirational goals without needing to specifically cost them or suggest how they're going to be done. And that, I think, is a fair and adequate, accurate criticism. But this is also the sort of aspirational directions that they will be trying to influence policy and politics of education in New South Wales, should they get the leverage in either house of government to do so. So there you have it. As I said, this is a bit of an extended segment because it takes a bit of time to go through some of these policies. What decision people use to make to cast their ballot in a state election is a very personal process. As I mentioned before, I've joined the Public Education Party. I will be throwing my support behind them primarily. But there seems to me to be, we seem to be at a particular crisis point at the moment. And I would characterize the current government's policies as not really acknowledging or addressing some of the issues of that crisis. There's mention of it, but not really a clear commitment on how to solve it or how to address it. Whereas the opposition and the Greens have a bit more of a direct approach to tackling some of those issues. As I said again at the beginning, the media narrative at the moment is that this will be a close election. I have seen stories referring to this as potentially being the closest election for a generation in New South Wales. However, one other weather vane to look at when it comes to election outcomes is that of the gambling industry, because there is big money in betting on election outcomes. And as it currently stands, Labor have odds to beat the Liberal Party in the election of $1.18, meaning for every dollar you bet, you will get back $1.18, which is a way of saying that a Labor victory is as close to a sure thing as you can imagine. And the current government have odds of, I think it was about 4.2 to 1, meaning that for every dollar you bet, you would get back $4.20. Now, please, I want to make very clear, I am not encouraging gambling on the election, but when it comes to how confident people are on the outcome of something, you always look to where they're willing to put their money. And at this point in time, the bookmakers are saying very confidently that they believe that a Labor victory is a pretty sure thing. So that's just an extra little piece of information to consider as we go towards that New South Wales state election. To those people listening who are in New South Wales, good luck making your decision for the 25th of March. For those of you watching from around the country and around the world, we shall see if New South Wales becomes the next piece of the puzzle of the map of Australia flipping over from a coalition to a Labor government, or if we remain indeed a blue holdout. And for our American listeners, Australia still adheres to the more traditional colour scheme of red for the Labor Party, or red for the slightly more socialist-leaning party, and blue for the Conservatives. It always slightly baffles me how that got flipped in the United States. Anyhow, next episode, we'll be able to report on the election outcomes. But there you go. There's a look and some of my thoughts and opinions on the policies going into this election for what will be the third New South Wales election of this podcast's run as we approach our 10th anniversary. Just thought I'd throw that little plug in there. Anyhow, I'm going to take a short break now, and when I return, it will be with this episode's main feature, an interview with Olivia L. Zingray, a Victorian languages teacher who recently completed his PhD on students' motivation for learning language.
The Teachers Education Review is produced by teachers for teachers, exploring ideas to help improve teaching practices around Australia and around the world. If you like the TER podcast, you can help us to promote and improve the show. If you have an idea for a feature segment, a strategy you'd like to share as part of the Teachers Brains Trust, or if you would like to leave comments or feedback on one of our episodes, then please visit our website at terpodcast.com, where you will find information on ways to contribute to the show. To help promote the show, leave us a rating and a review through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, or whichever portal you use to subscribe to the show. Share your favourite episodes with colleagues, other educators that you know, or with anyone who has an interest in learning more about education. Finally, if you are organising an educational event and would like it to be considered for a feature on the Teachers Education Review, then contact us via email at info@terpodcast.com. Thank you for supporting the Teachers Education Review. Now please enjoy this episode's main feature.
Olivia L. Zingray is a Swiss-born teacher in Victoria who teaches high school French. He recently completed his PhD on understanding student motivations for language learning, particularly the interaction with study abroad programs. In this interview, we discuss at detail Olivia's research, delving into the concept of student motivation and what it is that motivates students to continue learning, particularly in the context of high school languages. So here now to discuss student motivation for languages is Olivia L. Zingray. Joining me now from Victoria is Olivia L. Zingray. Olivia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Cameron. Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, we're here to talk about your recently submitted or has it at this point actually been signed off? The last I saw online, you've submitted this, but still has to go through final revisions.
Yes, that's right. So I finished the final revisions. I've uploaded the final thesis online, and that was only 2 days ago. So the university will do its part now and hopefully sign off on the revisions. I've given my thesis following external examiner's feedback. So that's where we're at.
Excellent. So your recently completed PhD thesis, awaiting confirmation and conference of the title. So on that regard, first of all, congratulations on achieving something that many people want to do but struggle to while working full-time as well. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm sure there'll be a bottle of whiskey or something.
But before we get into the topic of your thesis, can you just give us a little bit about your educational background and how you've come to be teaching here in Australia?
Yes. So, I was born and brought up in Switzerland in a French-speaking side in the south of Switzerland along the Rhone River. I was brought up in a sort of small village my mother is English, my father is Swiss, and I went to high school where I did the classics. That was in a local town, and the classics means that I learned Latin and a variety of other languages, including Italian, German, and English. And I mean, languages was always something that I was interested in. I started university in Switzerland, in Lausanne, where I began in English and philosophy. But through family upheaval, my parents were separating. I actually ended up leaving Switzerland and take advantage of my British passport that I had then. And I started university again in Leeds, in Yorkshire, where I did French and history. And during during that time, I went to teach for 1 year in Lyon, where I met my wife, who's from here. She's from Melbourne. And I found myself in 2004 in Australia, having had no family ever travel here and absolutely loving the place. But the plan for me to become a teacher had always been there from pretty much as young as I can remember. I wanted to be a teacher. I thought I was going to be an English teacher, to be frank, but I ended up thinking that maybe teaching English to native speakers was going to be a little bit over my head. So I decided to go for my own native language.
And so now you're teaching primarily French to high school students, and you've completed this PhD thesis looking at the motivation of students learning a second language and how that's affected by studying abroad. Can you be a bit more, can you give us a bit more detail? What actually were you investigating in detail in this thesis?
All right. Perhaps I should start with why I actually started the thesis in the first place. I think that there's a lot of language students language teachers who are going to be going to recognize this experience. But I initially, as a teacher, I was struggling with a specific year level in high school teaching them, and that year level was the one that was just before the transition or the from compulsory to elective language, essentially the last year of compulsory language learning. I was really struggling with that. And I thought I would go back to university to try and find out a little bit more about why these kids were struggling to engage, why I couldn't motivate them, what was actually, you know, what was there hung up there. And I ended up interviewing a number of students for my thesis. And instead of only looking at that, I ended up looking at the entire trajectory from the first year of high school to the final year of high school. And in addition to that, and this is where study abroad comes in, because I was myself traveling a lot as a high school student and later on as a university student, I was also interested in what it meant for them to have the opportunity to travel to France and be immersed there for a few weeks or a few months. And decided to have a look at how that particular experience that is not taken up all that much by Australians. There's only about 2,000 students across Australia who participate in a registered exchange program each year. And that was pre-COVID. So I don't know what the numbers are now, but they would be much lower than that. And that was essentially that was I found that this particular trip for Australian is something, you know, so much more special than the ones that I took part in when I was a teenager going to Germany for a month. Because Germany was just so close, you know, but these Australians, they travel across the world. And sometimes I'm looking at parents and I'm surprised that they take the risk of sending their 14, 15, 16 year old, 20,000 kilometers away, maybe.
Yeah. If something goes wrong on such a trip, there's no, you know, overnight road trip to go and get them or bring them home.
Exactly. Yes, and I mean the literature in study abroad is awash with horror stories. So, but usually, actually, the study abroad research that exists primarily focuses on university students. So these students are already adult, and I mean the only reason that this is the focus is because the people who do the research have a very convenient sample of students. So I, in essence, went with convenient sample as well, since I'm a high school teacher. But these obviously in my study are not my own students.
I see. So when doing a study, I'd like to unpack some of the elements of your concept there. When studying a concept like motivation, how do you define and identify motivation through the research process? What is it you're actually looking for from interview responses that you can then quantify or qualify as indicators of motivation?
All right. That's actually quite a complex question, because essentially what I did was to read until the literature was coming out of my ears, because motivation is not something that you can pin down very easily in terms of a definition. However, there is actually a sort of agreed upon very basic frame of what motivation is. So it lies in three particular concepts. So there's direction, magnitude, and persistence. By this, I mean direction. That means, you know, people have a goal. Magnitude is, you know, how motivated they are, and in the knowledge that this can fluctuate quite a lot from moment to moment, or from week to week, or from month to month, or year to year. And the persistence is how long people are ready to invest their effort into that. So if we think of motivation as having basically these three elements, there's a whole heap of different ways to then theorize it. So in my thesis, for example, I took two different theories. One is called self-determination theory that was created in 1985, or that was proposed in 1985 by two researchers, Dissy and Ryan. And maybe you don't know the name of the theory, but what you've heard of are the two main concepts that people have been throwing around quite a lot since, which is intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So we get a lot of our ideas from what extrinsic and intrinsic motivations are through this particular theory. But that was 1985. So this is already quite a long time ago. Are we talking 40 years, something like that? So so there is definitely this theory I wouldn't say is past or irrelevant at all. It's very, very relevant. But this, in addition to a much more recent theory, which is called the L2 motivational self system. So that second one is very specific to language. And this essentially proposes that that motivation is an action of the self or an identity, whereby a person who experiences the learning of a language is able to, through that experience, create some idea of what it would be like then in the future to be speaking the language or to acquire some level of competency. So putting these two theories together, I sort of created an interview process by which I was seeking to find essentially what these high school students could tell me about their current and past experiences of language learning, why they were motivated and what they thought about that they might become in the future. So they could be, you know, it could be small goals like I just want to have a good mark in the next assessment task, or it could be something much larger like, you know, I dream of living in France. And all these future goals are sort of, I wouldn't say that they're equally valued, but, you know, they are all valid for somebody's motivation. They can all motivate someone. So, yeah, essentially that's the process of finding out what motivation is. So I went really into what was the experience of the students and what they thought they were getting out of it.
And you mentioned that what sort of set you down the path of doing this PhD was a bit of a drop-off in engagement or participation of students after that last year of mandatory language learning. Did you identify or do you identify motivation as the sole or primary driving factor behind that change? What's the relationship between what started you on this PhD path and the role that motivation plays?
Well, you know, when you're in a situation when you're facing 25 students and you know that 17 of them do not intend to continue on in your language, and by the second half of the year, you know, any sort of work that you're trying to get them to do is falls flat, however you may prepare your class. It's a you're living very much in the moment. As a teacher, that was my experience. I was trying to find, you know, what is it, you know, it's so how can I organize my next class in order to grab these kids' attention and get them, you know, a little bit engaged into my thing. But what I was not actually understanding here is that the way that I was seeing at that point was actually the result of 2.5 years of history previous. And then I couldn't do anything about this history, but it didn't mean necessarily that they had a bad history in language learning. All I needed to do was perhaps to actually draw on what was positive within their language learning, and to try and actually remind them of these past positive experiences, while at the same time sort of trying to get them to understand what they could gain out of it for the future. But there's another point that is really quite important, and this has been the point of conversation with my supervisors on a number of occasions. If a student stops studying a language after, in Victoria mainly, it's year 9, it's not that the language learning was unsuccessful. It does not mean that. Because, you know, these kids have, at the end of year 9, they get a variety of maybe, I don't know, 20 different subjects that they can take in senior years. So the difficulty in that is how do we, you know, it's difficult for a teacher not to feel a little bit that it's a personal thing that the kid doesn't choose your subject, but it's far more complex than that. So kids can be motivated in year 9 and still not choose it later on because they may have other interests. So the ecology of high school, if you want, is actually really quite a complex and really dynamic one, where the motivation can be used and can be harnessed by teachers to ensure that the experiences of language learners right up to the point of year 9 can be a positive one where the kids can be engaged. It is difficult, but it can be done. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm successful every year or every moment. I'm not saying that, even after my thesis. However, I think I feel better ready to take on the challenge of a year 9 class and start to tap into those dimensions that I know are more likely to motivate a kid. So, for example, in the experience, I'd be very tempted to create a good relationship, to try and give them a sense of autonomy in terms of allowing them to invest an effort and at some time to, you know, sometimes to be a little bit further back and not to panic if that happens. And to the possibly the third one, which I think is the most important one, is a sense of competency. Something that really came up from my study that after I interviewed all these kids is that it did not matter whatever level they were at or their ups and downs in motivation to some degree in a short period of time. What these kids really wanted was the sense that they were progressing in the language. So progress is really fast early. You know, in year 7 and 8, the language is new. The teacher is usually quite fun. And by the time they get to year 9, and we start to focus much more on assessment tasks rather than actual language. And there's another topic that we could talk about later on. Why are these kids experiencing any sort of pleasure? And they need to understand that they are progressing in the language, that they can say new things, that it is relevant to their lives. You know, there's not one kid that's going to really seriously tell you that they don't want to travel ever in life. There's not one. Everyone does. And so so you can actually really take on this aspect and say to them, look, you know, we can do something that's really useful for you. And, you can order something in a cafe or restaurant. You can actually go and visit the Louvre and understand a little bit about what they say about the Mona Lisa. I don't know, something like that, you know? So the idea of progress is to me something that has to be absolutely part of that particular year 9. Just as a, sorry, I know I'm extending this answer a bit, but when I started teaching and I was seeing a group of disengaged year 9, I thought, okay, they don't want to do this and I'm not a mean person. I actually like kids, you know. I want them to like coming to my class. So let's ease off and not put too much pressure on them. So in one sense, yes, that wasn't a bad idea, but the way that I did it was entirely wrong, because what I did was maybe they want to do a cultural stream instead of language stream. But that was the wrong idea. These kids became more and more disengaged, because why would they be interested in a culture of a language that they are forgetting very, very fast? I needed them to still continue progressing in the language. So that's, I need every student, whether they're continuing on or not at the end of year 9, to understand that I will not accept anything less than continuous progress and effort. So the assessment tasks now are turned, and this is something I've been working on at my place of work. Most assessment tasks are speaking. And the reason is that is because there is no way to cheat around it, if you want. They have to actually be able to speak. And it's a virtuous circle, in my experience, that once they can actually speak better, they get more engaged and more motivated. It doesn't mean necessarily they're still going to choose language the following year, but they take something out of the language. And certainly the experience of teaching year 9s has changed quite a lot, in my opinion. It's much better nowadays than it was. So, yeah.
There's a couple of things you mentioned in that response I'd like to draw in on, particularly as they apply to your research. Yep. You were talking about how important like a couple of years of experiencing a sense of progress and development was to students' motivation, as well as recognizing that a student not choosing to continue language beyond the compulsory years may not actually be about their motivation to study language, but more about other contextual factors like the high school environment and the whole sort of choosing subjects to graduate high school and that sort of thing. Yeah. And, you know, for context, when I was studying at uni, one of my lecturers in psychology had written a deliberately provocative paper about the idea that all forms of motivation were basically just a social construct, intrinsic and extrinsic together. He was doing it deliberately to push a point. I don't think he actually pursued that theory very far, but that idea of the context of motivation in your research, how important were those contextual factors in getting to the heart of understanding a student's motivation, and how did you tease that out through your research process?
Well, you know, there's no question that the context is hugely important in sustaining or allowing a motivation to emerge in someone. You can't become interested in language learning or in any learning if you live in some sort of vacuum and there's no relevance to anything. So there's definitely the context was hugely important, and there were things in the context that were more important than others. If you think very broadly about the different elements that are present in a teenager's life, the family, the peers, and the teachers, right? I mean, if you really think down to the what actually impacts their learning, the important people around them, we've got these three elements. The family and the parents were hugely important in creating sort of the early sort of conditions from which a kid could even adopt a positive attitude towards language learning. So if you've got kids and you've got the ability to travel and to make them discover a little bit of what the outside world is like, then that's actually an amazing first step to language learning. There were case studies that in my thesis, there's a couple of case studies in my thesis that actually looks at how some of these travels previous to high school occurred and allowed these kids to become more motivated. But then in the school environment itself, the teachers appeared to be much more important and motivating a factor than the peers. In that sense, socializing needs to be understood what we mean by actually socializing, because the kids aren't socializing with their teachers for friendship, right? They actually rely on teachers for very specific reason. I think that, look, I accept as a premise that all humans want to learn. And when you're in an environment whereby you have the opportunity to learn, I think that it is clear that it is those elements that lead to learning that are going to become predominant. So the peers are important because they can sort of shift your way of thinking, and they can create together with the student a positive or a negative, you know, atmosphere in the class. And certainly, in the last year of compulsory language, it's often quite a challenging environment that we're encountering. But what is it that these kids can look at their peers and say, well, hold on, I don't want to follow the major trend here. I want to actually be something different. That's where the teacher really does come in and is able to have such an impact. So I know it's that some people who might feel a bit shocked, but in year 9, particularly, so the final year of compulsory language, a teacher who is able to maintain discipline and control over the students. And I know I hear myself say this and know how old fashioned I sound here, but this is able, a teacher who's able to do that is able to maintain students' motivation. If you don't have that as a basic, from what these kids were telling me in my thesis, you can't keep them motivated. And some of them did actually lose momentarily their motivation because the teacher, I mean, that's what they say, but it is their experience that counts, right? So I know it's not objective, but if they say to me that the kids, that the teachers aren't able to maintain discipline, and that was what demotivated them, I have to believe that it is true. And it is not just one kid that tells you that, but quite a few of them. So I'm not trying to tell you this as a blame to teachers. That's not what I'm trying to do. But we have to understand the experience of kids from the kids' perception, because motivation is not felt by Jack. It's felt by the student who's sitting there in your class. And it is a personal experience. So that's why their perspective, whether it's objective or not, has to be understood and taken into account. And that perception is entirely influenced by the atmosphere, by contextual factors, by past, you know, past experiences with families and previous attitude to languages, by family values. You know, that's what we're talking about. So I wouldn't say that your lecture was entirely wrong and say that it's a social construct, but I think it's so much more than that, that we can't just simply say it's a social construct and that's it. So we can't do anything about it. You know, that's not what it is. So yeah, but you know, send me his email.
Well, I think he has long since retired, but, another thing you mentioned, was something you wanted to, you could potentially unpack was the impact of the growth of an assessment approach to teaching languages as students get towards the end of that compulsory language period. Did that come up? How did that come up in your research?
Essentially, the participants are telling me that that what was motivating them was not to know, you know, the mechanics of the French past tense, but it's more to do with what can they actually say. I'll take an example of one of the kids. This is this kid is actually the last case study in my thesis. I called him Rowan. And Rowan actually had a pretty run-of-the-mill sort of experience in the early years. He was happy to be there, but he also told me I was happy to learn and happy to give it up if need be. But when he started to study languages, in his school they did two languages at once. They did Japanese and French. He was getting higher grades in Japanese, but he decided immediately to give up on Japanese and to continue on in French because the distinction was that in French he could talk, and that was the purpose. Where in Japanese, the focus of the class was more on kanji and other aspect that was much more linguistic than communicative, and so I mean, Rowan was not the only example in my thesis, but he is one that I actually kept in mind when rethinking how I was going to organize assessment tasks. And I figured out really that that the aspect of communication, and particularly listening and speaking, are the two dimensions that I really do need to foster in my students. And I do think that it has been quite successful. I'm sure I haven't got the final answer here, but I do think that it's been much more successful than trying to give them something that is too mechanical, grammatical, where everybody can get 100% if they've got a logical mind, but can't answer questions like comment tu t'appelles. You know, it's these are the things that I'm looking at. And so speaking is so much more motivating than any other form of language learning, for sure.
So if I understand what you've been saying correctly, it sounds like a key aspect of maintaining motivation in language learning that's come from these student interviews is the ability to use it in a practical, meaningful way, primarily speaking and interacting.
Absolutely true.
So were there any other findings from your research that caught you by surprise or anything that came out that you weren't expecting?
Yes, there is quite a lot actually, but I'll just contextualize the thing that surprised me the most. In these participants that took part in my thesis were all essentially they were all motivated, and the reason they were in my study was because they were going to participate in a study abroad, so they had to already have chosen to continue on in the language in order to be able to go to France. What surprised me is that these kids were able to adapt what they could be invested in and essentially their motivation to what the context had to offer. So I want here to understand that the context offers some limitations, but these limitations at the same time create new opportunities. By that, I mean that if the school, by the nature of what the school does towards the end of high school, which is to try and prepare these kids to then get onto their next stage of training, whether that be university or a trade, these kids need to focus on assessment tasks, okay? So up to year nine, I'm saying communication has to be number one. But after that, these kids are invested into what gives them the best possible future that they've chosen for themselves. And for this, what they need to do is to be able to actually perform well in assessment tasks. It sort of bleeds my heart a bit, I've got to say, because I feel that I go against what would be my ideal for high school language learning. I want these kids to come out of high school and to want to go to a French-speaking country and to live there, be part of a community. I don't want them to, you know, to write an essay in year 12 and have a tick list where they use the pluperfect and the passé composé and the imperfect. You know what I mean? So when we don't, towards the second half of high school, we don't create a genuine environment of language communication. We can't do that because they need to perform in the examinations. But that is, and at the same time, creates this additional motivation, which is much more academic. And it did actually surprise me because I had assumed that the whole of students' motivation was geared towards this communicative ability and competence. But it wasn't only. It really was associated and combined with a very strong sort of academic identity that they forged as they grew through high school. So that was one of the things that I hadn't quite expected, because I was essentially, you know, interested in these kids who were going abroad. And this going abroad was entirely geared towards it. The first goal was not really to leave a cultural experience, although it was part of it. It was to be able to grow in the language sufficiently to go up in the rankings in their classes. So when they could return to the class, they could perform better than they had previous to their thing. Mm. So that had surprised me a little bit, because I had expected that to stay a little bit on the back burner, but it became very forefront actually. That did actually surprise me quite a lot.
You know, thinking about that in the context of what you said at the very beginning about just how few Australian students do participate in study abroad programs, and it seems to me as though, and I wonder if this came out in your research, given that you were doing sort of in-depth interviews and sort of narrative analysis with students, it would be my anecdotal observation that for most English-speaking Australian children, the notion of living overseas, especially living in a non-English-speaking country, is simply not something that is a default assumption of their lifelong expectations. You know, I mean, I'm myself not originally from Australia, though I come from England or from the UK effectively. But even there, you know, the idea of spending time abroad, because it is just a train ride away, it is just a short flight away, is sure. So much more of a reality. And so I'm wondering, did you ever touch on, you know, you mentioned in that last answer just then how you do want children to be able to go and live and be part of a community and speak in a language and live rather than just have an academic checklist. But did that feature at all in many students' concept of their life as a possibility?
Yes, it did actually. I think that we tend to go with the assumption, it's true, that we're fairly insular in our way of thinking. I would dispute that. I think that we do get the notion that everything is quite far away from us. However, you know, when you think about New Caledonia, it's only a short flight away from here. This is French-speaking country. I think that we can certainly do more to to shift, I think, our students' attitude towards really sort of getting the idea that living abroad is actually totally normal. Now, I don't have statistics here. I don't know how many people grow up in Australia that end up living abroad. I don't know how much they are. I can only assume it's far less than in Europe. I mean, in Europe, you know, I'm from Switzerland, so literally half an hour away was Italy. And so, you know, it's you do grow up with that notion that there's no reason why I wouldn't do that. And the language is no barrier. I think there's two aspects to this. One is that, yes, there's certain kids who would never even imagine living Australia. And then there's the other side where currently it seems to be perhaps more of the middle-class kids who understand that there are opportunities outside of Australia and that they can do this. The reason I say middle-class kids is because it seems like at the moment, traveling is very much an economic factor. Mm-hmm. And so, you have families who can afford to travel and many who can't. I don't know what the secret is to get these kids whose family can't afford to travel to be open and interested. Many, I'm sure, are. And, you know, they grow up in very open values. But they certainly don't have the same opportunities as kids who grow up in families with the means to travel once or twice a year. So that's one aspect that I'm not entirely sure how to address it, because it's an entire different, I think, area. But I do think that we do have such a large variety of language already spoken in Australia with a lot of families. I think the statistics are between 30 and 40% of Australian families have another language at home. That it's a, it's, you know, we must understand that we are completely multicultural. We are open to new experiences, and the kids leave those experiences whether they stay in Australia or not, actually. But it wouldn't be a bad idea to sort of push them out the nest a little bit. So I do try to speak to families and my students as early as possible in year seven and to let them know that this possibility exists. Yeah, even if it's just traveling. In relation to the economic factor, just so that the listeners can also understand this, currently in Australia, if you want to send a child for 2 or 3 months abroad on exchange when they're 15 years old, it'll cost you around between, you know, $8,000 and $11,000.
Right.
And $8,000 and $11,000 include plane tickets and absolutely everything for this. So this is the one-off cost. So it sounds like a fair bit of money. It's true. But here's another way to think about this. How much does your teenager cost when they stay home in terms of food, clothing, schooling, transport, everything around the house? I'm sure not that much. However, we're still talking, you know, a good couple of thousand, if not a little bit more dollars, right? So I think we can try to balance that with the type of experience that they may be able to get abroad. And really said to the families quite early, this opportunity exists. Can you put something on the side? Can you get your child to do some work on the side and earn some pocket money so that, you know, in the long run they can do this? You know, that's I think there are ways to go about it, and we can certainly encourage our young people to do a little bit more.
So then, Olivia, for those students who do get the opportunity to study abroad, or particularly during their high school years, what mm-hmm. did you find in your research were the major contributing factors to its impact on their motivation?
Okay, so when students leave, when these students actually left for France, they experienced immediately two different experiences. The first experience had to do with the host family and that particular context, and the other one had to do with the host school and that particular context. So these are very different. And the first thing that students say, if you ask them, how was your trip abroad, is something like, well, the family was amazing. They were really supportive. You know, they really were patient. They were helping me. They were adopting family strategies to just for me to be there and to learn as much as possible in the language. But when they go to school, you get a totally different experiences. Many students come back saying the teachers ignored me. They had seating plans. I didn't have a word. I didn't understand what was going on in the classes. It was a very difficult experience. And some of them, you know, say to me, I haven't learned anything there because I couldn't understand anything. So these are two actually different. There's a distinction between something we called immersion. And immersion is where you communicate in the target language, but you have access to your first language as a support to that. You must understand that access to the first language still means that, you know, 95% of your communication occurs in the target language.
Mm.
In the school environment, you don't have the time to search in your dictionary. You don't have, you know, the kid sitting next to you translating or helping you formulate a question. And in the meantime, the teacher is throwing all this information at you. It's a wall of language. And so this is what we call submersion. And the immersive context is much more, at least in the early stages, is much more helpful in language learning than the submersive context. So it doesn't take super long, but it takes maybe a month, maybe 6 weeks, for a student to actually be in France or wherever they're going to start to really be able to participate in those classes, understand the what's going on in those classes, and to take something out of it. Because most students in high school, particularly the Australian ones, only go for a very short period of time. They can go for, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and sometimes for 2 or 3 months, but there's fewer and fewer who do that. I created a sheet for my own students that actually targets the high school environment, because what I want them to do is to be able to take as much out from classes in the submersive environment as much as they can. So the sheet actually contains a few different sections. The first section is list 5 words from the class that you understood, just like that. Just 5 words that you understood. In a space of one period, they can do that. So already they're framed, they have to focus on the content, and they can't panic if for the next 20 minutes they haven't understood a single word. There's another 30 minutes whereby they can actually get some stuff. The second one is list 5 words that you heard, but you don't know what it means. And you can write it phonetically. Okay, so there's another one there where I'm trying to develop sort of a greater ear and consciousness of the language, whereby students are starting to write that. A third one is, what's a question that I can ask? So I want the students in as many classes as possible to ask one question to the teacher. So they need to, so there's some question starters, like, for example, you know, I won't say it in French, but what does this mean? Or on what page should I open my book? Or, you know, questions along those lines that allow the student to make their presence actually known and for the teacher to not ignore them. So I find actually these three sections to be quite helpful in getting the students to navigate that submersive context so that they can actually leave there and really get to actually know a lot more. But how do these work in terms of motivation? It's all about progress, right? So these kids want to take something out of there that they can then re-inject in the classroom once they're back from the exchange. That was the first motivation that actually get them to travel over there in the first place. They want to improve their results in high school. Of course, they want to know the experience and everything. I'm not forgetting that. But a big, big factor of going there is to be better at school. So through managing the the host school experience, where they're going to spend maybe 60% of their time, because school in France is much longer than in Australia. You know, you start at 8 o'clock, you finish at 5. So these are very, very long days. They need some support, and the teacher doesn't have the time to support over there. And why would they? The teachers over there aren't invested in the occasional visitor that's there for 3 weeks. No, they're not. So the student really does have to find the means to take something out of this enormous chunk of their experience abroad. And progress is the key, in my opinion, here.
So, Olivia, at the end of this process, what do you think are the primary implications for your research for high school teachers of languages?
Okay, so the primary findings for me, or the primary implications, is that teachers can impact motivation. This is not a given game. We can actually have a student in our class and bring up this motivation by tapping into those three important dimensions of autonomy, relatedness, and competence. And we need to also, another thing is, help kids see what there is in the future for them. So whether it's short-term goals, as in an ability to order something in a cafe, or if it's a long-term goal, you know, how about traveling in 3 years from now for 5 weeks and to New Caledonia and play soccer there with your team? I don't know, something along those lines. I think in essence, never forget that motivating a kid, whether they're continuing your language or not, is going to shift potentially their attitude towards a positive attitude in language learning. We live in a predominantly English-speaking country, and we have this stereotype of English is spoken everywhere in the world. Yes, it's true. It is. But there's nothing that can replace the ability to speak more than one language. And if you want to really experience what it is like to communicate with people in France, in Japan, in China, wherever you want to travel, learn the basics of the language and go and immerse yourself, go and live it and try to practice. I think that these are the things that I would like to be taken out as implications.
And finally, on the subject of completing a PhD while working full-time as a teacher, do you have any advice to offer anyone else who's thinking of going down that same path? What lessons about the process did you really learn along the way?
Right. Maybe number one is have really good coffee, because there's going to be a lot of late nights. It's true. I did actually work full time during the length of my thesis. Also, I saw my son grow from a toddler to almost a teen. And one of the things that I would say is make sure that you organize your time really well, because you don't want to sacrifice too much of your family time. So make sure that you don't sacrifice that part, because the kids do not come before your PhD. And in terms of the completion itself, is don't get discouraged. There's some parts that are really tough. I mean, I remember spending weeks and weeks and weeks transcribing interviews, and sometimes having to repeat a 3 second portion of an interview 50 times because I couldn't understand what the recording was saying. And it's horribly frustrating. In my fourth year of PhD, I gave my main supervisor a call and I said, look, I'm not even sure this is for me. I don't know that I can even finish it. I was struggling to write one of the final chapters back then. And I was feeling pretty down, I got to say. And I went to, so I was still working. And on one particular occasion, it was student teachers interviews. And I was good friends with a family whose mum was doing a PhD as well. She had literally just completed it. And I was telling her about how difficult I was finding it all. And as you know, having written, rewritten and rewritten this bloody final chapter. I couldn't get through to it. And she said to me, stop writing the final chapter. Stop writing the conclusion. Why don't you write instead a case study? And I said to her, look, no, because my supervisors expect the conclusion. But then about 24 hours later, I thought, stuff it. So I started writing this case study, and suddenly, you know, at the end of one evening, I had 2,500 words, and then they were okay, and I was like, okay, we unblocked something. So this mum of my student, who I will not name, but remains very close to my heart nowadays, unblocked something that I couldn't get through. And it was, I think that's one of the things that I learned through that is, if you feel discouraged, don't keep it to yourself. Really speak up. Stay connected with the other people who are doing something similar. Speak to your colleagues, even if they're only pretending to listen to you. Just speak up and don't get discouraged. It is worth it. It is worth it. Knowing that you create knowledge at the end of this, knowing that you contribute actual knowledge, is actually a feeling that that can't be replaced either. And it's something that I can take to my classes, something that is practical, something that I've learned from listening to teenagers speak to me for hours on end. So these are the things that if you're going to get involved into a PhD, particularly in education, and you want to speak to kids about their experiences, enjoy the ride. It's a tough one, but you know there's really a lot to be taken out of there.
Well, Olivia, once again, congratulations on reaching the end, and thank you very much for taking the time to discuss your research and what it implies for the teaching of second languages in Australian schools. Thank you once again for your time.
Thank you so much, Cameron. It was a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
And that was Olivier Elzingray discussing his PhD thesis on student motivation for learning languages. You can find him on Twitter or as a regular participant in EduReading, hosted by our own Stephen Kolber. Look for the links in the show notes to this episode at terpodcast.com. And that brings us to the end of this extended episode. We had two long segments there, so well done on sticking through those if you did. The New South Wales election promises to be a potential turning point for education in New South Wales. It's going to turn one way or another, I suspect. Either it's going to be business as usual and the crisis will deepen, or we may see a change of direction, though whether that change of direction actually addresses some of the underlying issues, we will have to wait and see. But next time I talk to you, we will hopefully know the results, and we'll find out whether the media are correct and it is the closest election in a generation, or whether the bookies have got it right and Labor absolutely walk it in. It brings us to the time to shout out our patrons. If you would like to support the TER podcast and continue listening to these extended interviews and discussions of politics and education, you can do so over at patreon.com/TER podcast, where you can sign up for as little as $1.50 an episode or $3 a month as an early career patron. Or you can sign up for $6 a month as an accredited patron, where you can join in the conversation and contribute questions to upcoming interviews. You can sign up as a highly accomplished patron for $10 a month and get a regular shout out at the end of every month. Or if you've got unbelievable amounts of cash to throw around, sign up as a highly accomplished patron for $50 a month and get a opening credit and thanks at the beginning of every single episode. That being said, let us thank and welcome our newest patron, Neil, who signed up in the past month. Thank you, Neil, for your ongoing support. And also, because our episode at the end of last month was a TER Topics episode, I need to thank our highly accomplished patrons, Lee and Malcolm Young. Thank you for your ongoing support at that $10 a month level, helping us meet the ongoing and often increasing costs of funding this podcast and keeping it going. We appreciate all of your support. And of course, if you do not have the money to throw towards a podcast on the internet, then the best thing you can do to help us out is to share an episode with a colleague, share one of your favorites either on your social media or by just emailing it to someone who might be interested in a particular topic and helping us grow that audience that comes back to this podcast fortnight after fortnight. We appreciate all of the time you spend listening to us and hope that we can continue doing so well into the future. That being said, that brings us to the end of this episode. I'll be back in a fortnight, but until then, this has been the Teacher's Education Review.
Thank you for listening to the Teacher's Education Review. All opinions expressed in this episode are those of the individual speakers only and do not represent the views of their employers or any other affiliated organisations. For links, show notes, and information on how you can contribute to the Teacher's Education Review, be sure to visit terpodcast.com.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network. AEON.net.au